Our purpose today is to look at building projects, specifically building or whatever that you're looking at. I'm sure there's a lot of other issues and problems with school funding that you'd like to discuss, but today we're focusing on building projects specifically. And so I would ask that we try to sit on that topic as much as we possibly can. To start with, let's go around and introduce everyone. I am Tim Faust, a representative from right here in Warren. And you can just go around this way and tell us where you're from, who you are, and why you're here.
And John Carson, as you can see, I represent the House District 43B, which is in Jonathan Park, the city of Plymouth. Three school districts. Three. There we are. School districts. Hopkins, Montana, and Wayzata Schools.
I'm Brad Kelly with the House People Research Center, all of the Capital Finance Committee.
I'm Connie Carter, I'm with House GOP Research
Center. Craig Schultz, I'm Superintendent of Brain Schools.
I'm Fred Nolan, Superintendent of Foley Public Schools, one of the 21 capital-owned school districts in the state.
Gary Olson with Ellers & Associates, representing Masbo.
Carol Peterson from Princeton School, representing Masbo.
Sam Olseth, I'm a lobbyist with the Minnesota Rural Education Association.
Everyone last is Superintendent of Schools, Pine City.
I'm Kim Eisenshank, I'm the Superintendent of Black Rapids Grade School.
Kurt Blundell, Superintendent of Stock Rapids Rice School, and I've talked with you folks before about PS Minnesota's funding formula. I'm not here to do that today. Mm-hmm. One of the things I was told was that you might be talking about that service equalization. I have a keen interest in that.
I'm Brian Moore, the Director of Buildings and Grounds for Hutchinson Schools, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Maintenance Supervisors.
Thomas Hummelbeck, I'm the Board Chair here at Mora.
Jeff Conway, Superintendent of Schools in Mora.
I'm Michelle Weber. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education.
I'm Shannon Patrick. I'm the Committee Administrator for the
Health
Capital Finance Division.
All right. Just all the work on our end. And I want to thank Morris School for letting us be here today. We appreciate that. And with that, what you'd like to start off doing is talking about the problems that you have with the current system. When we were in the K-12 Finance Committee, we oftentimes heard from school districts where roofs were leaking and water running through parts of their school, and they had tried for years and years and years to get some type of a letter passed to replace the building and couldn't get it passed. And that's just one example of the problem that people have with the current system. Capital equalization program, I know local leaders in that and some of the problems that they have with that. So any problems that you've got, we'd like to hear about. But we'd also like to spend some time talking about ideas to solve the problems that you're having. It's easy to complain about something, but we'd also like to hear what ideas you've got as far as fixing the current problem. You know, PS Minnesota, I believe there's some possible solutions in there for that. So we'd like to hear what ideas you've got to try to figure it out. I hear lots of guidance from the school board, superintendents, the school board members. The city can raise taxes, the county can raise taxes, the townships can, but we can't do it without everybody getting into it. So to start with, I don't know if you want to go around or you just want to somebody start talking. I'll call on Doug. He's always got something good to say.
Something to say, maybe not good. Specifically to facilities, we've got a couple of issues here in Mora right now. The first one being aging facilities. Second issue is we're crowded, beginning to be more and more crowded at our elementary levels. We already are somewhat crowded in this building as a 712 finishing new high. Main problems for us, we do not generate enough funds on a yearly basis for capital projects. Anyone that I've talked to, and I've talked to numbers of people who do buildings and maintenance and everything, they will tell you that between 2-4% of the worth of your buildings should be spent on capital projects yearly. For us, that would be 2% would be about $1 million, and 4% would be $2 million. Last year, we spent more money on capital projects than we have in any year previous to that for a long, long time, and we spent 250,000 dollars, which is half of a percent. If we continue to spend the half of a percent of the worth of our buildings on capital projects on a yearly basis, you can expect them all to deteriorate to the point where they become uninhabitable. Now, when it comes to building new buildings, a couple of facts I'd like to share with you. The Orono School District passed a bond last fall for $39,500,000. 20-year bond, tax burden on $150,000 worth of property in that school district is $63 per year. A year ago, I asked Gary to run some numbers for me on a potential bond in this district. We had considered the cost of a K-8 facility in this district at $34 million projected. Tax burden in this district on a 20-year bond on $150,000 worth of property is $339 per year. What I glean from that comparison is that districts with the least wherewithal to pay taxes are being taxed at a much higher rate for the same amount of revenue than districts that have a little bit more wherewithal to pay. I don't know what the answer is, but I know what the answer is not. That's not what they're doing right now.
I see a couple of different issues here, and it was touched on here, but the first part is we need to find...
Brian, I'm saying, before you speak, since this is being taped, I need you to tell us who you are.
Okay, I'm Brian Moore, the Director of Buildings and Grounds, Hutchins and Schools, representing NASMIS. I see it as a two-part approach that needs to be taken. One is we need to really look at maintaining the investment in the infrastructure that we already have. Looking at everything from standards for staffing levels, standards for financing for actually maintaining those. The other part of it is new construction. I borrowed this phrase actually from another organization I belong to, but we've, in some essence, become a repair by replacement state. And when we don't have the adequate funds to maintain what we have, we're forced to replace. When the gentleman here spoke about the levels and what it takes to maintain a building, is unfortunately many districts, because they don't have the capital funds to adequately, or the operational funds to adequately maintain the facilities, things deteriorate quickly, so you get to a point where they're no longer maintainable. Some way, shape, or form, there needs to be an objective condition assessment and an adequacy assessment of the facilities throughout the state. If you look at organizations like MDOT, they have road inspectors, they have bridge inspectors, but we don't, as an organization of K-12, have school inspectors. More public schools just paid a private firm to come in and do an assessment of their buildings. We have in Hutchinson, I'm sure many other districts have done that. Montana, the state of Montana, just commissioned a study with a company called DLR to do a statewide assessment of their facility. Now, that being said, there needs to be some sort of a nonpartisan prioritization of where the biggest needs are throughout the state. And the demographics, the shifting of the demographic patterns within the state need to be taken into that, but I see the Department of Education playing a role in that. There, right now in the Department of Education, there is a very, very small facilities branch, but there isn't the staffing there, nor are there in the school districts to adequately assess the need that's out there. We don't have a very good number of what the backlog of repair is, the adequacy of the buildings or the condition of the facilities. So what I say is, two approaches and two phases to it is to maintain what we have and then some ability to get out from underneath what that backlog is.
Greg Lundell, Stock Rapids Rice School Superintendent. And I appreciate what you said, Representative House, that you're here to talk about the problems of really the school construction. But it's really important for all of us to understand that these are all intertwined. We're running a little bit late this morning because we were in a budget meeting with our administrative team, and we were trying to figure out how we're going to cut $1.5 million out of the program again for next year. And one of the last things we talked about this morning was the capital fund, the fund that would be used to repair roofs and to maintain boilers and do all of those kinds of things. And what we were doing is we were essentially trading off any capacity that we had for a physical plant in favor of trying to maintain class sizes in the unfortunately high 20s in our elementary schools. So there was a trade-off there. So the challenges in the on the adequacy of the basic funding or the basic formula side really do crosswalk into this. It's also linked to the operating referenda that are available. We passed a $60 million bond issue in 2000, and we passed it with a pretty significant majority, and everybody felt really good about that. And we, in fact, received in the first year of our bonded indebtedness over $2 million of equalization to help us pay that debt. And as happened all across the state of Minnesota, ANCCs have been rising. The formula was frozen in place. And today we received $300,000 in equalization toward our debt obligation. And so what's happened is that our levy today is about $7 million. $2 million of that is a result of the loss of equalization over the course of the last 7 or 8 years. We went before the voters this fall to ask them to give us some money. We're one of the very few non-referendum districts in the state. Ask them to give us some money, and they rightfully said our taxes are high. They are high. And, you know, with $2 million less on our levy, we'd have had that much greater opportunity to leverage the tax base, so to speak, for our operation. They're really interlinked as far as we're concerned. So we know that a solution on the debt service side in terms of equalization will help us on the education side as well, both in the capital fund and also in terms of the ability to get at some of the resources that others others currently enjoy.
Carolyn Bostic, Plain City Schools. And I guess I've looked at this whole thing. I've been a superintendent for 20 years in several different districts. But, for all state districts like Plain City, we don't have any wealth. There's no way we're going to build a $21 million new elementary school, even though it's desperately needed. We've got another high school that we use it in elementary. And for me to go to the voters and say we're going to basically demolish the school and build a 21, it's just like saying, you know, stupid or whatever on my forehead, because it's not going to happen. We don't have any wealth at all. And our kids deserve those facilities, just like the kids in the other districts that have the wealth. And I'm not saying that. But I think that, you know, over time, the formulas have not caught up or stayed up with what's going on. And we're fortunate to have a referendum in place for $839 per pupil unit that raises a lot of nice money for us to be able to do facilities and build some new tennis courts and did some things that we wouldn't do otherwise with that referendum money. But the formula is, you know, basically do not work. And the other part of it is you need to find a revenue source. When we sit down and negotiate, we always, you know, my line to the teaching staff is, where are we going to fund this? That's certainly what has to be done. And I think when Governor Ventura was in place and we did the property tax shift, that killed us. I had a lot of people in Pine City saying, I didn't need that rebate. But it happened and we went back to the 1% and we're paying for it. We are the schools. And then the shift from basically the state, Greg mentioned it, where they don't get very little CDA compared to what they had for their equalization for debt service. They're one of the few schools that even get any debt service equalization. We don't get a thing in Plain City. Could we afford it? Would it help? Yeah. That's what Doug's talking about, too. But you got to find a revenue source because there's not enough. You can't take it on a high, and you're certainly not going to give us authority to levy that ourselves. And we can't afford it anyway. So, you know, it's a huge issue. And, you know, I'm here just because, you know, all state, our kids deserve what other districts have, facility and as far as program-wise. We're good fortune to have the programs because we got the referendum money. But without that, you know, there's no hope. And that's pretty much what Greg was saying, too. It's, they're all connected. We try to, you know, let's not fix the roof this year and wait a year, and maybe the legislature will help us all on the other end so we can fix eventually the rough leak. Thank you for coming out today and listening to us.
Sam Allstedt with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I'll be brief because you have real people who live with this every single day. But I just want to make one comment. Debt service equalization to me is kind of the cornerstone of this, and that formula is so woefully broken at this point. We're back to where we were almost 15, 18 years ago when this formula was first put in place. And this is, I mean, you're going to hear kind of a common theme about the loss of state aid on that equalization formula. Representative Mark Ward and Welty and Demmer all have legislation before the House and in the Senate as well that would do good things. Keep working on those items. And there might be some other options or opportunities too, with maybe looking at deferred maintenance options for school boards, at least to be able to have some authority or some control over putting some resources into at least that ongoing maintenance type needs. But I'm going to stop at that.
I'm Carol Peterson. I'm here representing MASBO and also Princeton Schools. And I can tell you from looking at Princeton Schools, we're similar, except for we are in a growing district. Currently, we are leasing 25 modular classrooms. We've been trying to pass a referendum, have not been able to pass one. So as you mentioned earlier about not getting support, that is one of them. It's also very hard to stand in front of all your taxpayers and tell them it's going to be an increase, and then when they ask you how much the state is going to be paying for it, and you have to tell them zero because of the equalization that hasn't really changed since 1998. It's very hard to fill your taxpayers. And one thing for us, too, because our debt is only around $19 million for five buildings, for us to even get any state aid, we would need to have something passed for $100 million, which we all know that's not going to happen. We have buildings that range from 1948, 1954, 69, 66, and 1999. Our buildings are very old. We have our whole second grade out in a modular building, which is really sad when we have kids that are saying, are you the principal of this building too? Because our modulars are so large. Funding capital projects, something we really need. The lease levy, we are over our amount for leasing in our school district currently. The $100 doesn't cover it for us. Maslow's platform is to increase it to 175, which for us would help that amount for us. Operating capital, we talked about roofs earlier. And right now in Princeton, my estimate to repair my roofs is at $1.4 million. We have HVAC issues, which comes a little over more than $10 million. How is one school district supposed to be funding all these issues when they can't get anything passed? Our HVAC was part of our referendum. In our last referendum, it was to build a new elementary, add 16 classes down to another elementary. It's very hard for our school district and other schools in Minnesota that are having these kind of issues. I have a high school that was built for the kitchen for 600 students. We have 1,200 in there. We have four shifts for lunch. Start serving at 10:30 in the morning. I could probably go on and on about it. Here you go.
Gary Olson with Ellers and Associates. We work with lots of school districts on building programs. We help issue bonds. And so we see this on a regular basis working with districts, and we put together a lot of the information, the tax impact that they go to the voters with and say, you know, if we do this project, here's what it's going to cost. And, you know, go to their public meetings, listen to them, ask about, you know, how much is the state going to pay, and generally say very small amounts. I think there's two real issues here. One, you know, when you talk to school finance, you talk about both adequacy and equity. And on the adequacy side, I don't think there's enough money in the capital programs right now. There are several programs out there. There's the operating capital, which is for equipment and facilities. That number hasn't been increased since 1992. At the same time, I think there's been higher and higher demands on that program as you want more technology and those kinds of things. And so they're getting squeezed there. The alternative facilities program is great, but it's, for most districts, it's very limited because it has to be health and safety qualified. as opposed to the 20 largest districts in the state, which have access to that for deferred maintenance and other things. So there's some issues there that, in terms of who can have what. But the other thing, I think capital facility bonds, which a lot of districts are using for like guaranteed energy contracts and things, are limited to 10 years. They would work better at 15 years, and that wouldn't cost the state anything. It wouldn't cost the taxpayers anything. It'd just spread out the cost a little more. Health and safety requirements could also be increased. And as Carol said, probably the lease levy could also be. All those things would help districts have more dollars available. As far as the debt equalization, we've been putting together information on that for a number of years. Back when debt equalization first was implemented, it was phased in over 3 years, and the first year of implementation was 95, where it was fully phased in. And for the next 3 years or 4 years, the state paid between 10 and 11% of the eligible debt. For fiscal 2008, we're down to less than 2%. So the costs are going up every year in terms of debt service, but the state share is going down and down. At its highest point, the state paid about $37 million for debt service. Projection for 08 was more like about $14 million. So the state has, what's happened is the share, when you sell bonds, you kind of fix your payment, and your payment's going to stay the same every year. In the first year, you might have a $10 million payment, and the state picks up $2 million, and so you levy $8 million. Well, as time goes on, eventually these districts end up levying the whole $10 million. And so that just shifts over onto that tax, makes it harder for them to do anything else or pass a new bond issue or anything else to help fund those. One of the big reasons for that is the increase in the property value. Property values have been going up and up, yet what's called the equalizing factor, that number that's set in state statute that determines state versus local share, has been frozen. And what happens, and I actually have a graph, unfortunately I don't have enough copies for everybody, but I do here. Okay, it's in here. Okay. And what happens is there's a blue line. This is the equalizing factor, and you can see it's been frozen, and this is what's happened to state share, property value per pupil. And you divide this number by this number, and if it's over one, then you don't get any state aid. So as long as this red line is above that blue line, you're not getting any state aid. And we have a formula now that with two tiers in it, where there's a lower equalizing factor and a higher equalizing factor, but that lower equalizing factor is at the point now where about 92% of districts don't get any aid. So what you have left is a formula where you have to get to 25% of your value, of your adjusted net tax capacity. You have to have a debt service payment on an annual basis that high before you get any state aid. And that's an awful high, levy rate in order to even begin to qualify for state aid, except for that 8% of districts that happen to get some money in the first year, which is pretty rare. So
what was that number at in 98 when they first set the current number?
That equalizing factor?
Yeah, you said it's 25%. What was that when it started?
Basically, it started at, I believe, 10. I mean, it's changed over time. And part of the issue is...
It was 10,
but there was only one tier at that time. And everything above 10 was equalized.
What Gary's saying is that for most districts, it's at 25% because their value per pupil is so high that they don't qualify for the first tier. So that 15% cut doesn't apply to everyone. So that lower cut point was more relevant when there were more districts.
I piggyback on that because Bruce said something relative. One could argue that, well, you know, like Stock Reference Rice, 2000, our AMPC was 9.6 million, and today our AMPC is 20 million. So, wow, we've really doubled our property worth in the district, so we really don't need the equalization anymore. But if you take a look at it on how do we rank relative to the state, we rank about exactly the same place in the state today as we did 10 years ago, because everything has moved forward. So if we were entitled to debt service equalization in the year 2000, we are equally entitled on a property wealth basis today.
See, I think the issue is that the equalized values have gone up. They haven't adjusted the equalizing factor. And really, you have to kind of look at the change in value in two ways. The bulk of it is just plain inflation, where some of it is new growth. And for the new growth, it makes sense that if you have a lot of new growth in a district,
then you really have more taxpayers, more property kicking into the pot, and it probably makes some sense that they can have less equalization. But for the bulk of the districts, what you're looking at is most of that value growth is just strictly inflation in the market. Those people aren't any better off now than they were before, but what happens then is essentially you kind of have a flat tax rate, and every year that collects more money from the local taxpayers because their value goes up every year, and so then the state just says, okay, we can contribute less. And that's really what's happened.
I apologize for the copy, but this is a chart that was prepared by Ehlers, and I've used it in the past. And in 1995, the equalization factor was actually two-thirds the average ANTC. And now you can see it's less than half. Those lines crisscross in 2001. There is a second tier, but as you said, you have to have an enormous debt in order to qualify it. So most districts would qualify for the first tier. I'm Fred Nolan, Superintendent of Schools in Foley. We have a maximum per capita loan, which is why I got very involved in the debt service formula. And this is why many of the stories you hear from districts that do not have relatively high values of commercial industrial property. And so, therefore, the tax burden either falls on homeowners or, like in the United South Central and some of the western areas, on ag land. And I can't remember this district, maybe Brad, you remember, there was a district that relatively 10 landowners were going to fund 90% of the project and said, wait a minute. And the town said, wait a minute. And so...
I think it was McLeod County West. Or
I think so, McLeod County West. So I think there's some real specifics here, but I just want to just pass the chart out. This is what Gary's referring to.
I'm Brad Lundell, Executive Director of Schools for Equity and Education. I didn't realize I was at a STEAM meeting today. All my members are here. I think, echoing on a lot of things, it's, H.L. Mencken said for every complex problem, there's a simple answer, and it's usually wrong. And the difference between me and H.L. Mencken is I'll give you a complicated answer, and it'll probably be wrong. But I think that there's a bunch of things that I think that Gary picked up on, and just to take them a little bit further, the equalizing factor has changed. It's remained constant as a kind of a percent of the total statewide ANTC, but you have to remember in the 1990s that they were buying down business property tax classifications. And that was balanced out on a statewide basis. And when you balance that on a statewide basis, the districts I represent have very little commercial industrial property. So they were actually getting a lower equalizing factor that was not reflected, and was they were getting a lower equalizing factor because the equation had been balanced on a statewide basis, and because of that, they're penalized for having no commercial industrial property because their equalizing factor is artificially low compared to their district. I think the other thing is, in talking to Princeton's case, back in 2001, we met with Dean Barkley when we were talking about the big plan, and we said, you know, we would appreciate, or we think it's better to leave some level of general education formula levy in place and to equalize or to put, you know, kind of buy down and do more equalization at the same time. And so target some property tax relief through this big plan as well as to do a general property tax buy down and to balance that out in a better way. I think the lease levy is a prime example of a levy that's totally unequalized. And so if you look at Princeton compared to a higher wealth metro district that may be leasing the same amount of, same number of classrooms or the on a per pupil basis, the tax bite in Princeton is going to be much, much higher than it is in a district that has high levels of commercial, industrial, or high value homes. I think that there's some very straightforward things that we can do. I think that trying to combine, as been said earlier, kind of into a sense as to what each district needs in terms of facilities, and then to create programs that mirror those needs as opposed to having kind of a one-size-fits-all, or I shouldn't say a one-size-fits-all, but this kind of narrow paths. I mean, it seems now that we've got strands of a rope and we need a rope. And I think that's hopefully through this that we can, you know, these kinds of meetings that we can come to some of those solutions.
I'm Fred Nolan, Superintendent Foley, and I'll just talk a few problems. I'd like to come back later and talk about some solutions because I have spent some time with these people thinking about this. I listened to St. Francis. They had mold in their portables. They now have kids on stages, all places. You want to hear some problems? Have them come and testify. Have United South Central come and testify. I understand that their building was condemned. They can't get the local taxpayers to pass a referendum. And I guess the question, I think the policy question, I really appreciate you coming out here on a really cold day to talk about this, especially John, Representative Benson from Minnetonka, about an hour and a half drive up here probably. What is the minimum level of facility in the state for Minnesota's children? And does the state have a role in setting that minimum standard, much like MnDOT, like Ryan said, or is it really just kind of up to the voters? Is it really right that 25 classrooms of Princeton's kids are getting out in today's weather and going across to have lunch and then going back to their classrooms? Or is that unacceptable in Minnesota? That, I think, is a policy question you need to ask. And then, yeah, I think you've got a bunch of tools that I'd like to lay out some ideas of how to put them together in a more workable way that sort of balances out some of the power between the state, the school boards, and the voters. Because I think it's a little out of whack. And it is so unique from district to district, because I sit and listen to testimony, such as you hear before the House Education Finance Committee or Senate Committee. Every the combination of property values and needs almost creates something that needs to be tailored. And so I have some suggestions on that a little bit later I'd like to supply.
Craig Schultz, Superintendent of Brand Schools. You can see why we hire guys like Gary and Brad to take on this charge. I did go down and listen at the State Department, listen to some of the testimony, and I have to agree with Fred. There's so many different things that across the state, different situations, different problems, that sitting and trying to come up with a plan that's going to address everybody is really a very difficult task. We were very fortunate back in 94 that we did pass the bond, and we did upgrade our buildings. That puts us in a very difficult position because of the newer buildings, along with our older buildings, we get much less deferred maintenance to take care of the old buildings that we have. We have gone back with a bond three different occasions that have failed. We do have an operating levy. We did come out this fall, and it was very difficult to go before the taxpayers and say, we would like you to pay us more so that we can maintain the buildings that we have. The economy is very difficult, and it's in a very difficult situation to go to those taxpayers in a school district with over 40% free and reduced lunch and say we need more money. We were lucky when we talked with Ellers. We said, what do you think we should take a look at as far as amount? And they said, well, how about the state average? That should be a good place to start. Well, if we would have come out with a state average, we would not have passed it. So we're significantly below the state average, and we passed it at a 52%. Now, if we did have the ability to say, you know, we don't have to go to the voters anymore, we just can come forward and charge the taxes based on what we need, is a wonderful idea. Until, as Darwin said, when you get there, the money's not there. So if we're going to go and have the ability to tax in a situation where the money isn't there, it's not going to help anything. Now, when I talked to some of our taxpayers this fall and asked for a slight raise in the operating levy that we did have, they said, what do you mean? You've been raising our taxes for the last 10 years. And that's because of this loss of equity. As that's gone down, as you can see on the chart, when our building took place in 94, along with our operating levy that was passed 6 years ago, we haven't made any changes in 6 years. But our taxes, our local taxes, have gone up every year because of that shift in equity. And so coming up with a plan, I don't envy you at all sitting in this difficult spot that you're in as far as old buildings, some buildings that are newer buildings that don't have the deferred maintenance to take care of them. It is all interlinked with the operating money. We have let things go on some of those older facilities until sitting in the choir room on a rainy day, you don't know if some of the ceiling tiles are going to come down. And so we can't continue down that path, and we keep letting things go, that now we're at a point that we can't let them go anymore. And so I guess that's probably why we're all here today, to meet with you to talk about those things.
It's come up several times, the relationship between different pots of money.
and maybe Greg, you're the one to answer this, but there's probably several people that could. As far as facilities, is that one pot of money and operations is a separate pot of money, or those two together are the same pot of money as far as maintenance for facilities? Follow the question?
Yeah, I'm sure they can talk about it. So the capital account is a reserved account in the general fund.
It's going to be spent on maintenance for them.
Mm-hmm. There's prescribed uses of that money, and that's the operating capital revenue.
But you can buy textbooks out of that, technology out of that.
You can pay for staff.
You can pay for staff that relates to the technology. And what we've seen, to some extent, is and it goes back to Greg's point about the fact that there's a shortage, you know, that the two are interrelated, is when you get to the point of doing budget cuts or you get short in the general fund, the first reaction is keep the cuts as far away from the classroom as possible. So what happens is they say, okay, we've been funding our technology coordinator out of the general fund. We're going to slide him over into operating capital. We're going to find anything we can and slide it over to operating capital to keep the general fund as healthy as possible. And essentially what you're doing then is now you don't, that just makes this problem of not having enough money to fix facilities even worse.
It's a reserve fund. And ours is a reserve fund of about $800,000. And this last year, we found general fund expenditures that could be coded in capital and absorb the entire $800,000. I mean, we didn't spend a dime on a roof, on a door, on anything this last year in order to try to reconcile it all in accordance with the rules. Now, I'm not arguing that you change the rules because we had to cut another $750,000, $800,000 out of our classrooms had we not had that ability.
And there are four additional pots. One is health and safety that was referred to, and that gets approved by the state, and it's a levy. One is all finance, which the top 20 districts in the state can do. Okay. One is the lease levy, which Princeton is using. And one is the capital lease levy, which is based on energy efficiency. And so you have these tools at your disposal. Some districts have all the tools, some have a few of the tools. And what I think you're hearing is that the rules on these are so tight that it's difficult to really make a comprehensive project. And I think we ought to look at Duluth. In fact, I've got some information about what Duluth did. And you want to hear a solution, I think you ought to invite Duluth down to talk about their solution. Now, there are some unique things about Duluth, but I think they point the way to how to be creative. One of the ideas is to make all these different pots in a sort of a block grant approach, that the school board could then levy more for health and safety, extend the financing to all school districts within limits. Lease levies, if you're not donating the lease, but you want to apply that to debt service, you can do that. Because you already have the authority to lease. But if you want to apply it to debt, not leasing, why not do that? And you also actually have the capital loans for energy. You've also got the Macron for Capital Loan Program that's been sitting out there. You made it almost, the legislature a couple of years ago made it prohibitive for a district to get into it. And I understand the rationale, because you want to make the debt service equalization formula work. I think you've heard it's not working. Maybe you go back and look at that program as well. So you've got a number of tools out there that already exist in law. And I'd recommend we look at them and see how they can make it work so you
I'll go back. When you mentioned those four pots of money, those are all local board levies that they can authorize on their own.
The alternate financing, I believe the 20 largest school districts in the state can, and yes, they do. And if you, I'll pass some more of these out. And if you look on the back pages from Duluth, let me pass those down. Here is the information from Duluth that they gave to the public on this. The average of those school districts is $1,060 per pupil in alternate financing. Okay? And currently the operating capital reserve is $220 per pupil, I believe. Am I close on that?
It varies by district based on the age of your
program. Oh, that's right.
But the average is just over 200.
So the districts you see in the room here are restricted to about 200. per pupil. The 20 largest are spending $1,060. Now, these projects go through the Department of Education. They get approved, and you put together a five-year plan. I'm talking at the edge of my knowledge about this because I don't have one. Okay? The lease levy is up to $100 per pupil, but that's for leasing. But again, it's imposed by the district. The capital loan, it depends on how much energy savings you're going to get, and Gary referred to those now as being limited to 10 years, made those out to 15 years. It would work better in the bonding process. But they're all capital investments that boards can do. But because they're isolated programs, you can't put them together and say, we can impose taxes of X to help pay so much of a bond. And then you could go to the voters, let's say, for the other two-thirds or half or whatever you needed, because the board could put the half on or the third, whatever it is.
There's a little bit of difference in the programs, too, though. Like the operating capital, that's an authority the districts just have.
Yep.
Same with the deferred maintenance. That's an authority they just have. Health and safety, you have to submit the projects to MDE and get approval. The alt facility program, similarly, you have to submit projects. And for most of the districts, they have to come up with at least $500,000 of projects that are health and safety related in one particular building. Then they can sell bonds. Otherwise, they have to do it kind of the old-fashioned health and safety way where you do it kind of pay as you go.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a different, some of these programs, there's different levels of state involvement in terms of, you know, what can you do on your own versus how much you can do without the state involvement. And obviously anything, any construction project over $500,000 requires, no matter how you're going to finance it, requires what's called review and comment.
And I'm recommending you ask MDE or ask, you know, your staff, Greg Crow, to begin looking at how you put all those together so that you could package them. You could still use them the way they are, but still package them. The way Duluth did, if you look at this side of Duluth's information, they packaged the lease levy. And I apologize for the copy. I don't quite know why it came out before. I didn't see it just before I came here. The alternative lease facility, the general fund savings, they were going to save operations in general funds. And so I can only presume that they're going to dedicate some Fund 1 money to pay down debt. What they were finding with small elementary schools is they had so much windshield time for art specialists and music and principals that they were going to be able to save operations. But again, I'd have them testify, Superintendent Dixon and his people, to tell you exactly how to do it. But this is how they came up to finance the $293 million, by putting these programs together. Now, they do have an advantage that their lease levy is unlimited because they're a desegregation school. Okay? But still, their actual total indebtedness was not going to be larger than Minneapolis. It was going to be smaller than what Minneapolis has under the same programs. So one option on the front is to take these current tools, and I'm kind of about four bullets down, kind of recommend a solution here, and package them in a way that it's not 100% voter approval or nothing, but maybe a third of the approval authority lies in the school board. Maybe a third lies with the voters, and maybe a third lies with the state. And you can increase equalization factors. I frankly, looking at the amount of money you probably have to spend, which you notice over the state policy concerns, what percentage of total state resources should be spent on this thing? Not the dollar amount, but what's the percentage? If 50% spent on education, what is the percentage in facilities? And set that, and figure out how to best get your bang for your buck. I'm not so sure. I think raising the inflation factor, and I've done the math, would probably cost you more than if you went back and looked at the maximum for capital loan program and said, okay, how do we allow really struggling districts to apply to the department, have the department give you a list based on a budget and say these are the districts who should qualify for a loan, and then let them go out and get voter approval for the remaining one-third of the project. I think you would fix the most difficult, intractable, frankly, un-Minnesota standard facilities for kids. And I think at least get it to a minimum level of acceptability across the state of Minnesota and target your resources.
I think another thing that comes into play here, and some of this, part of the problem is this is an authority of the Education Committee. Part of this gets into since it falls under property tax, since a lot of it falls under the property tax committee as well.
Yep.
And I think there's two things here. When you increase equalization, you don't necessarily give anybody any more money. What you do is change the aid levy split, and you get back into the legislature, and then it becomes whose committee pays for that. Is it tax relief or is it education aid? And certainly the education committee generally says, we're not giving schools any more money. We think the tax committee should pay for it, but the tax committee doesn't necessarily want to do that either. So I think that's one problem that you have in this in terms of just who's going to pay. The other issue I think it gets, and we've seen this especially since 2001, is operating referendums are taxed on a totally different tax base than the bond issues, and it makes a lot of difference in terms of especially rural communities. Because you can go out to a rural community and get an operating referendum, and the farmers only pay on the house garage 1 acre. Cabin owners don't pay at all. When you put the bond issue on there, now the farmer pays on the entire value of his farm, all his buildings, all his land, and the tax burden is very different. And over the last few years, you've seen farmers come to the legislature with and their groups, you know, saying we ought to spread the taxes different. And again, that's something that's totally outside the education committee's purview, but it's important. We've seen a couple districts where in the past, on a very small project, rather than vote on a bond issue where they wouldn't get any aid, vote on an operating levy, where they're going to get some state aid, and it's also going to be gentler on their farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a, you know, whose ox do you gore? Do you get the homeowners and the farmers, or do you get the businesses? And, you know, and it's kind of depending on which one. And so that's a whole other ball of wax that's outside of this, but gets involved in this as well and just makes it, you know, again, back to, you know, simple solutions for complex problems is kind of hard to find.
Right. This little game is being played with some of the other sources of money, the health and safety money. There are districts within shouting distance of here who were able to go out and represent their taxpayers that by voting yes on an operating referendum, they were going to be able to lower taxes because they were going to be able to back off on some health and safety authorization that they've gotten. They got equalization on the operating referendum. They weren't getting equalization on health and safety. So people were coming to us because it happened to be a neighboring district saying, well, they're voting yes, and they can lower their taxes. How come voting yes and yours increases your taxes? And you set up a whole dynamic of discussion within a district that is vested in trust, that's vested in policy-level decisions that are, I won't say questionable, because, frankly, if we had the alternative, we might try to exercise it as well. But it's just the rules of the game aren't the same from place to place because of some of these variances.
I'd like to pick up, too, on what Gary said about the it's frustration. I really want to commend the House. I think Representative Dreiling and who's your tax chair? I can't remember.
Linchesky
and Representative Marquardt on the property tax have worked to try to make, I mean, property tax relief is how you spend it is where it's going to be, and you have to figure out, you know, what should be the state's focus of the property tax relief. Obviously, we're all educators in here, so you can pretty clear answer from us as to where a lot of those things should go. But I think that's the legislature as a whole has to look at, if you're going to buy down property taxes by X amount, X minus what goes where and X minus the remainder goes someplace else. And I think that's a discussion that we do have to have. And, you know, we've waved the Constitution under people's noses a lot, but I mean, the transportation and education are the two constitutional mandates that the state has. I like fire trucks. I want a fire truck to get to my house in a hurry if there's a fire, but there's no constitutional guarantee to a fire truck. I think what we're talking about with statewide focus and how we're going to have the property tax system meld into that for those state initiatives, those state priorities is very, very important. And I think I want to, again, commend the House for kind of elevating that interplay between education property taxes and property taxes and other for other purposes, and hopefully that's going to, over time, create better understanding of how the system should work in each of those areas.
I want to remind everybody, when you start talking to this, say who you are again, even though you said that many times because it's on paper and they won't pick you up. That one a little while ago, you had your hand up. So.
Well, I think, you know, I'm kind of a basic guy, and you can do all the gimmicks you want, but you're still going to have the haves and the have-nots, and I still see it as a revenue issue. You got to, you know, find the money to fund these things. And like Brad said, it's education is one of the state's obligations. You know, our kids deserve the same thing they have in Minnetonka, the same cost to the taxpayers. I keep going back to that. And that's why all of, pretty much all of us in this room are part of the Schools for Equity and Education. Thank you.
Doug Conway, Nora. You know, one of the things I think that needs to be done that has not been done, when we went to the plan for funding schools that we are currently using, which was proposed and passed by Governor Ventura, and that was the state taking over the cost, we have yet to identify what constitutes an education. And that's a legislative shortfall. That was your responsibility as a body to identify that. And you haven't done that from either an instructional or a facilities viewpoint. And I wonder if perhaps that isn't something that needs to be done, because otherwise we're trying to fix something we don't even know what it is.
If I can piggyback on that, Fred Nolan from Foley. Yes, we're using anecdotes. You're bringing certain districts to the legislature and making stories. But I think you said earlier, Representative Faust, that we don't have an assessment. I know Brian talked about MnDOT. They know the roads. And I know MnDOT's got a lot of criticism recently. But I do agree with Brian that maybe we should look at MnDOT as an example for being able to prioritize which of the facilities that absolutely need to be fixed and repaired. And that's why at the very bottom I've got an idea that's completely different. It says, okay, let's just walk away from the current equalization formula. As much as I admire Brad and Greg and understand formulas and equalization, I'm afraid the amount of time it's going to take to raise the formulas are not going to fix some of the problems for the kids whose schools currently are coming to school. And so I'd like to propose that if a district wants to go out and bond 100% locally, go for it. Hire your architect and go for it. But at MSBA, there were, 10 architectural firms down there? There had to be 8 construction management firms down there. That tells you there's money to be made in school facilities. And I believe, Darwin, you were the one who suggested it once. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the MDE had like 3 elementary plans and you chose one and you save all the architectural fees and they just make it fit your site? So if MDE actually beefed up their building department, okay, actually RFP'd for an architectural firm, had like 3 elementary plans and you wanted to participate with the state, they would build it for you. This is what you get. They prioritize the projects. If you want to locally raise the taxes and move up in line, you can. Or you can just wait for them to, quote, build you the road through town. Again, it would do what Doug has said. It would say, okay, the state's taking over the operations. Maybe there's also a minimum facility that you will build. It also get into discussions of, okay, you have 3 towns in a small area. Maybe you'll build 1 elementary and 1 high school. You 3 get together and figure out where you want them, okay, rather than equalizing all 3 towns. It's just a completely different way to look at it. And I really appreciate the opportunity of this roundtable and kind of lay out some thoughts and to have you at least mull them over.
Well, thank you. That's an interesting idea. Take a look at that.
You know, if you had the 3 towns and the 1 school, too, and you sent them all back home to their 3 towns for athletics, you wouldn't have any problems.
Sounds like you've been there before.
Now I'm going to split the fields, Minnesota, because you both listened to several different iterations of the concept plan that we've got in place. For Stock Reference, I would have to follow Fred by saying I'm not sure that educators across the state would embrace the state's 3 school plans, but nonetheless, what it suggests is the state sets standards. Within PS Minnesota, as we advocate for equalization, we recognize that there needs to be some state standards associated with that. There are places that are entitled to equalization, have been entitled to equalization. Frankly, it was probably not a good state investment because all the demographic studies, the direction that population patterns were going would suggest that that's probably not a viable entity over the course of time. So we would suggest the state does have a role in making policy, whether it's the policy that Fred is suggesting or some other. But what we would hope is that you would, in fact, take this on as a comprehensive solution. And instead of saying, I'm going to go in and massage that service by itself, independent of other things, you suggest, no, it's interrelated with health and safety. It's interrelated with capital. It's, frankly, it's interrelated with everything on the operations side, transportation, everything else. Some of what PS Minnesota suggested is that let's put a comprehensive package together. Let's move forward. The task force is looking at some of what we're doing. We're at the cusp right now of beginning to write new legislation, and I'm hopeful that one outcome of this is that you can go toward that task force and say, this needs to be a valuable component part. We have capital concerns that are unmet. Doug mentioned a few moments ago, you can do it on a percentage basis, you can do it on a dollar per student basis. PS Minnesota's got some research that would suggest about $600 a kid, or that 2% of the foundation formula. If that were there, there would be far greater measure of adequacy on the operations side because there wouldn't be that pressure. But it shouldn't be done independent of equalization and debt service. It shouldn't be done independent of capital loan programs and things like that. Please, I would encourage you to consider this as being one part of a far more complex problem still, and that solution needs to embrace lots of different component parts of the formula.
Gary Olson Ellers. Just one more thing. I think you've got a series of programs already. Some that the district has pretty much control, you know, just has authority for. Some that they have to go to MDE and get approvals for. And some they have to go to the voters for. I think right now in those things that are come up before you go to the voters, right now there's not enough money. I think most people here at this table would say there's not enough money in that group of programs now to do a lot of the routine stuff that you need to do. The question is, what is the right level for that? It needs to be higher, probably. And at what level of involvement between, you know, who's the decision makers? The school board is, and what role should MDE and the state maybe play in that process? And then when you go to the voter, once you get, you know, bigger projects or something bigger, and you do have to go to the voters, then I think that's where you really have to step in with the debt equalization formula or some kind of a way of controlling that tax impact so that you've got more equal chance across districts to do that. We've got roughly 340 districts. They're not homogeneous at all. I mean, you've got little tiny districts, and you've got great big districts like, you know, Osceola and Rosemont and Minneapolis and St. Paul. And there's a lot of diversity between our districts, and there probably isn't one solution for everybody. But some more flexibility and more balance, I think, is what's needed.
Brad Lindell from Steen, I think Gary said there's little tiny districts that should probably be with another little tiny district, and then there's little tiny districts that simply can't, that because of geography, just can't. I mean, I think that's where technology may play into this, and we have to talk about that and where that might. You know, obviously, you can have facility needs, but we do have to be realistic about some places probably to get up to the standards and need to get to are probably going to have heavier investments in technology. The one caution I give about the maximum effort program, this is from my time on legislative staff when Gary was in the department, and this was in the pre-laptop days, so that's how long ago it is. But one of the problems in U.S. legislators, probably since the maximum effort program is not as relevant now as it was 20, 25 years ago, was people would come and say, we really needed to have a maximum effort. Could you put in a bill so we can get a maximum effort? And all of a sudden, you get to the conference committee and somebody gets a maximum effort loan and someone doesn't. And how'd you do that? Well, we went in the conference committee and played scissors, rock, paper, scissors, and you know, somebody got in and somebody got out. It was a little more complex than that, but not that much, it seemed at the time. So I think that Fred's on to something, that if you're going to have something like that, you really have to have tight guidelines, like tight review and comment. And there's always going to be that friction then, because as we're all about local control until another point when we're not about local control, and when it's going to be good for us. So we have to be honest on our side of the table too, that we have to be able to say we're going to submit ourselves to these standards and we're going to live by the jurisdiction, you know, who's making the determinations based on those standards. We have to live with that and not go to our legislator and say, well, geez, we're just this close. I mean, I think that's the real challenge here, is we've got to find out this is a state, a state initiative. And if the state's going to set standards, they have to make standards that are going to be rock solid, and they're going to say, this is where the line is, folks. And if you can't get across that line, it's all over.
Brian Moore, Hutchinson Schools. And
I haven't been in public education that many years. At one point, there was categorical funding for facilities. So at some point through the funding formula, somebody decided that at least a minimum standard needed to be devoted towards facilities. And over the years, when funding has been deficient in K-12, there were legislative initiatives to remove that categorical funding. So this may not sound, I might not win too many friends with my superintendents or board members that are at the table, but the boards and the superintendents and administration of school districts have very difficult decisions based on the facts that are surrounding them at the time. Boards and superintendents are outlived by the buildings. And so sometimes you have to make that hard short-term decision at the long-term impact of deferring maintenance and deferring the facilities, which has got us kind of into this problem. There's, Kim's heard it before, but I talked about the bathtub curve of product reliability. And without belaboring it, statistically, when something ages, there's a higher rate of failure. And many of our buildings throughout the state were operating at that statistical high rate of failure on that curve. And we need to somehow, through new construction, deferred maintenance programs, get to a point where we can sustain the operations. Right now, there's a big iceberg out there. And like I said earlier, we really don't know what that iceberg is. We haven't done a very good job of analyzing the need. One way, shape, or form, we can't reward negligence. We can't reward a district for consistently taking that short-term approach and neglecting the taxpayers' investment in those facilities.
Carol from Princeton. Again, I kind of want to piggyback on what Craig Schultz was saying, too, about going to your taxpayers and they ask them for more money and they're saying, well, we already increased it. I can tell you from Princeton's side of it, on health and safety, it's all levy right now. Deferred maintenance is 15% state aid, 85% levy. Our capital now is 69% levy. We are going back to our taxpayers every year on our levies, increasing it. We have a small operating referendum for $325 per student. And in the last year, we increased over $100,000 just on that portion of what state aid is now levy. And capital money, I mean, that really hasn't been changed since the formula since 1992, health and safety. I think a lot of it needs to be really looked at, and it should be looked at and viewed as a property tax relief and not just money for school districts.
Kim,
I've been
sharing some Sacramento's Rights, and I actually am the business manager known as Sacramento's Rights, but prior to this, a couple of years ago, I was at Hutchinson School. And as I've kind of noticed over time, rural districts are finding, or we're finding that, like, Sacramento, we have a very nice facility because our taxpayers said yes to that. At Hutchinson, we could not pass the building bond if we tried to, and we did try several times, and yet we can get operating referendum. So districts tend to find that they're on one side of the coin or the other. And even, like, our friends from Graham, they have had a little bit of both, but they can't get the level that they need in basically either one of them. So we're finding that we're really having a hard time, I think, trying to work with taxpayers because they feel that they're being paid. They are paying just a fair share on one or the other, and they can't afford both. So I think that's where the real problem is coming in, is the have and the have-nots. And what that have or have-not is different in every district. And we may have wonderful facilities, but no money to operate on, or we may have operating money, but the facilities, we can't maintain. Thank you.
Yeah. We'd be happy to say it all over again.
Thank you. I guess that, you know, a couple things that I picked up. Number one, the program of equalization is not working. And tinkering with that by itself would help, but it's not going to fix the problem. And that we should look at a big picture approach to solving the problem. Does that summarize what I'm hearing?
Yeah,
and the sooner the better, too, it sounds like. I guess what a couple of things that I will throw out there, and if we don't invest in put these two cents with them too, is to take a look at where we are at on the state level. Someone made a comment that the DOT has taken a look and said, these are the roads that need to be fixed first. You don't have that situation in schools. And until we as a state or a legislature know where we're actually at, it's pretty tough to get people excited about trying to fix a problem that hasn't been identified or measured as to how big a problem it is. So I think that those are a couple of things that I would like to see us take a look at. It might be a difficult process to try to evaluate that. I'm not even sure how somebody would go about doing that. We'll let people that make more money than I can figure that one out, I guess. One might be to send out reports to all the school districts, have them fill them out, and have somebody drive around and look at all of them. I'm not sure, but we'll worry about that. So I guess that's kind of my take on it.
Just a general comment or two. I appreciate listening to all this. I grew up and graduated from a school district similar to this one. So even though I now represent these three districts I indicated, even there it's not all peaches and cream. Hopkins District, for example, just finally got itself out of statutory operating deficit. And they had to go through some very, very severe cuts. And this idea that the state has had since 2002, that all these issues can be resolved by simply having districts pass more and more operating revenue requests, that dog ain't going to hunt much longer, even in my district. There are many people. I have a large number of people who are on fixed income, who live in very, very moderate homes. Believe it or not, Lake Minnetonka does not lap onto everybody's backyard. For those who don't, this is getting damn tough for them. I spent my career in education, and I, as a classroom teacher, and I know that this state or any state has ever been particularly flush in blarding on money for school district. I didn't go into that to get rich. I'm not here in this position either for that reason. And so I was motivated to run for office principally because of these kinds of issues that you're discussing and what you're saying is accurate. And I would like a little sympathy from you, however, because we are facing some difficult times again, which my opinion was to a great extent self-imposed by previous legislative short-term political decisions that were made, which seemed wonderful for certain candidates at that time. And all of you and all the rest of us in the state are instead to pick up the mess that has left. So I will do what I'm able with this one single vote to try to convince my colleagues that these are pressing issues and they have to be dealt with. If we really wish Minnesota to be competitive, not only in the country here but internationally, education is the key for a little cold northern state like Minnesota. Unless some of you can find some oil wells somewhere out in your districts, that's the reality. So funding for education, to me, is an investment. It's not a periodic budgetary annoyance. So I appreciate being invited along and having the opportunity to listen to all of you.
Thanks for coming, John. I guess one other thing I'll add to what I said earlier was that, you know, we are in tough economic times right now, and I have for a long time said and believed that the best jobs program Minnesota ever had was 55 years ago when they made the decision to have the best school system in the world. And for the first 50 of those 55 years, our economy has outgrown the national average by a significant amount. And it wasn't until 5 years ago they started cutting back on education. And now, for the first time ever in the history of the state, since they started keeping records, our unemployment is higher than the national average, and our economy has grown
less than the national average. And that's, I believe, a direct result of the decisions that were made in 2002 in Princeton School Funding, in 2003 in Princeton School Funding. And so that's what I'm going to, I guess. But, I want to thank all of you for coming today, especially for Mark for hosting us. Appreciate that. And if you have any other comments or concerns or whatever that comes up on your way home, or I wish I would have said this, feel free to send that to John, myself, or somebody else. And appreciate that. And again, thank you all for coming.